Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 26 of Criterion Reflections. We're here tonight to talk about Zatoichi Goes to the Fire Festival, which, in my opinion and kind of my recollection, is one of the most star-studded Zatoichi films that I recall seeing. And tonight we've had a pretty star-studded cast as well. Very happy to be joined by Robert Taylor. Robert, welcome back.
Hey, David.
Yeah, this is your second swipe at Zatoichi.
You talked me into watching a second one.
Well, you hung in there, and I hope you feel a little more gratified for the effort than maybe you felt after the mild letdown, let's say, of Zatoichi vs. Meets Yojimbo.
I hated it.
Okay. And if you recognize that chuckle, that is indeed Martin Kessler. Martin, how are you doing tonight?
Great. I'm especially excited to be talking about this Zatoichi film in particular, so thank you for having me on.
Well, I'm so delighted to have you on. Martin, you were back with us way back in the early days of this podcast. We talked about a couple of Czech films, and really nice to see you back in the mix again. We're going to have you on a couple more episodes in the near future. But how you been lately?
Pretty good, pretty busy. I've got a lot of podcast episodes lined up for the near future over on FlixWise. There's an episode on Whitnail and I coming up. I've got an episode in the works about Scorsese's religious trilogy. So that's Last Temptation of Christ and Kundun and Silence. So if people like Criterion stuff, they should check out FlixWise, where they can hear more of me if they want.
Very happy to endorse your podcast. Lady P even got in the mix recently. I know she's been pretty busy with her graduate studies, but she did a very nice episode on The Third Man. And FlixWise is definitely, while they're not officially part of the Criterion cast scene, they're very closely affiliated, and I really enjoy what you guys do there. So really nice to have Robert, Martin, and myself as we get ready to pounce into this very bountiful, very rewarding, very satisfying 21st installment of the long-running Zatoichi saga. So, Martin, how about we give you a chance to kind of lead us into this conversation? You seem pretty particularly enthusiastic about this one, so what's your opening shot at Zatoichi Goes to the Fire Festival?
I like this one quite a bit because it's coming towards the end of the film series, but it still feels like everyone can kind of bring their A game and try to elevate it. And you already alluded to how amazing the cast is, but it's not just Nakadai kind of as the heavy coming in, after you have Mifune in the previous one. It's like, who can you get but Nakadai to follow that up? But, there's this great collection of character actors, and you have Peter from Funeral Parade of Roses in it, and this really fantastic cast. And I think this is the last one that Kenji Mizumi directed before he went on to do the Lone Wolf and Cub film, so it kind of feels like, even though it's so far into the series, everyone's just trying to find something new to surprise you and entertain you. And I think it's just a solid example of what makes these films fun and exciting and a little bit bittersweet.
It does feel like there's a lot of freshness and a lot of vitality in this particular installment. And in the last episode, Robert, and that was John Lobinger and I, we talked about Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo, which I guess for about a year and a half or a year and a few months was a bit of a reboot of the franchise. They took a longer time than usual between episodes, if you will, and came back with Toshirô Mifune reprising, in a certain sense, his Yojimbo role, and it sounded like just the world beater of all Zatoichi films. And maybe because it was a little overly ambitious, it didn't quite generate the satisfaction and the pleasures of Zatoichi that it might have. It's a film with some redeeming characteristics, I think, but
if you say so.
Well, let's not relitigate all of that, Robert. I'll just kind of go ahead and give my little caveat there.
Zatoichi versus Yojimbo, or Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo, being a little bit overwrought, and this one doesn't feel that way. I don't think it's a little bit lighter on its feet, and there's a bit of a back to basics. There's the Yakuza boss with the gambling, and they put an interesting spin on this one by having him be blind also, so he makes an interesting opponent for Zatoichi. And there's a lot of the characteristics that you kind of have come to expect from these films, but they try to find a new little spin to put on them, which I think that's partly why it feels maybe a little bit like a breath of fresh air after coming off of as Toichi Meets Yojimbo.
Yeah, even the runtime. This is more of your classic 96 minutes versus the 2 hours plus that I think the Yojimbo feature had going for it. But yeah, let's go ahead and get Robert's take. What do you think? This is what you're.
Oh, I thought it was like night and day compared to the last one, or rather, fire and ice, if you will. Ba-dum-bum.
All right.
But I enjoyed this one so much. I'm so happy that you and John pressured me into giving it one more shot. Because, like, I felt like just the little scene where he had the little stilts with the kids was better than Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo in its entirety. This one was it really made zero sense. I watched it twice, and I think I know what was happening in most scenes, but I don't think that that was the point. It was just going for a tone, and it perfectly hit the tone. The cast was wonderful, and I had so much fun with it. I genuinely now want to go see more Zatoichi films.
Rather than feeling obliged or pressured into it, now there's a genuine curiosity, a zeal even, if you will, for understanding the character and the franchise a little bit more.
Yeah, now that I know that they're good, I'm happy to keep going with the thing. And you're right, it felt, even though it was, what, you said 90-some minutes? Mm-hmm. It flew right by. It felt like an episode of a TV show, except albeit on a little grander scale and with tons of nudity.
Yeah, I don't think Japanese TV was quite flashing all the bare buttocks that we see in this particular installment, which isn't exactly typical, but you definitely feel the franchise is exploring some fresh territory, some expanded boundaries, if you will.
Sequence.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's outstanding, and maybe we can get to breaking that down a little bit more. But we've already talked a little bit about the outstanding cast, and of course Tatsuya Nakadai, the absolute iconic pinnacle of Japanese actors, as far as I'm concerned. He is the guy who can do it all. He can do science fiction. He can do serious drama. He can do, you know, ambling comedy, and he can be a complete badass. Lethal samurai killer, and that's pretty much his role here. You know, he has that impressive and inimitable crazy face. You sort of see that right at
that
the beginning.
Stare that
when
goes right through you, yeah.
Yes, and it's just like, whoa, you know, I can't even conjure it, you know, audibly, but the visuals are just outstanding, and Masumi, the director, clearly knew what he was dealing with, and he uses Nakadai to most impressive effect in what is in some ways just a supporting role. But there's another pretty iconic Japanese actor, Masayuki Mori, who is pretty well known. I think he was in Rashomon, and he has a pretty impressive host of acting credits. Martin, you got any quick references? Mori's a very familiar face.
Been in Kurosawa films all the way back to the beginning. You know, I think
sure.
He's in a lot
oh, yeah.
of those early ones. He's in Ugetsu, which we talked about over on
oh, that's
Flixwise
right. yeah.
a little while ago. And
that's right.
Yeah, a couple of the Mizuguchi films, Naruse films, Konichikawa films. Like he's been in all the big directors. I don't think any Ozu, but definitely if you're somebody who watches a lot of Japanese cinema, you've probably come across him a number of times. And this might have been, I think this was his last film role or one of them.
It is his last film.
Yeah. There was one other credit that he has. I don't know how big of a role it was, just a year or two later, but it might have even been like a TV movie or something like that. But yeah, this is, and for a pretty distinguished career, I think this is a pretty, you know, honorable way to go out, because he is a pretty supreme supervillain in this one.
Right. He's sort of the dark mirror image of Zatoichi, the blind Yakuza master pulling all the strings and taxing everybody. So
yeah, the boss of bosses. And I mean, he is kind of like a shogun of the underworld, because when he holds court, all the bosses are lined up in very supplicant postures and trembling at his every word and dreading that they might possibly fall on his bad side. So, you know, and the even the big payoff at the end, he has kind of this James Bond supervillain type of, demise in mind for our hero. So,
and he does play board games incredibly aggressively.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Their little Go match there is another little, just a wonderful moment. I think that's one of the things I just love so much about this film, is there's all these little moments from kind of comedy, ribaldry, some pretty intense sword play. And just the pacing and the framing and the filmmaking chops that Masumi shows. He was the director of the very first Zatoichi film, and as Martin, as you've already alluded, he went on to pretty much helm the majority of the Lone Wolf and Cub series. But he was kind of an original Zatoichi, shaper and mover, and he went on to other territory. And I have not yet dipped into Lone Wolf and Cub. It's coming up, obviously, in the podcast down the road, but this certainly whets my appetite for that.
I have a question.
Sure.
Does Zatoichi actually go to a fire festival?
Well, I don't know enough of the Japanese to recognize maybe what the literal translation of the title is. That fire festival, I was thinking, especially when I first saw the film poster, which I have embedded in the show notes and posted on my Criterion Reflections, the group Facebook group. You see Zatoichi pretty much standing in the buff, doing a one-legged sword-fighting pose with a very strategically placed little wooden barrel. I was like, well, so did this fire festival burn off all of his clothing or something or what? but it does seem a bit of a misleading title, because I was expecting him to be participating in some kind of Japanese pilgrimage ritual type of thing where they all dance around the fire like heathens or something like that. But that's not exactly how it all comes down.
I almost like that, though, because you sort of hear the title, I don't know about this, Zatoichi Goes to the Fire Festival, like, it's one of the later ones, maybe it's going to be a little bit boring, like, they've run out of ideas, and it's just him in the, twirling, like you said, sticks of fire, but then you get to the climax of the film, and it's these poles with the fire at the tips, and the lake gets set on fire, he's in this big trap, and they say, this is the entertainment of the night, and it's such a Bond villain moments, like you mentioned. Oh, yeah. And then, that's the fire festival.
you could have just chopped this guy up, hire a bunch of archers, put him in the middle, let them loose their arrows, and he's toast, but oh no, we have to be a little bit more elaborate and crazy than that.
Little pull away bridges, so he's stuck on that little platform.
Exactly. So what we have here, I guess, is the standard plot of the wandering blind swordsman, the masseur, really is what he starts off as, and he just kind of strolls into a town. I like the beginning shot of him being chased by this yipping dog, and it's a little light comedic moment, but he's kind of just back on the road again after the kind of the pomposity grandiosity of Zatoichi versus Yojimbo. We're back to pretty much ordinary time with Zatoichi wandering from town to town, and he strolls into a situation where he's giving a massage, and the occasion is, I guess, what you just have to call a slave auction. This is a slave auction of beautiful Japanese women who are being sold to men of some wealth and privilege. Basically, buy yourself a new mistress and enjoy whatever pleasures she's ready to give you once you've paid the price. But this is kind of our first introduction to Zatoichi as a heroic figure, a person striving for, freedom and justice for people who are, cruelly oppressed and poorly treated by the social order of things. And as he's giving a massage to this particular gentleman who's basically trading in his used merchandise for something that he considers an upgrade, Zatoichi decides to sort of take pity on the woman who's been purchased by this man, and sets up a little bit of a, I guess you could call it a kidnapping or a rescue is probably a nobler way of putting it,
Face, it looks like something out of a David Lynch film.
Yeah, but he does this little kind of spooky boo monster thing, and of course they drop the palanquin and he liberates the woman and takes her off into the bushes, and then that's when Nakadai makes his very memorable appearance. And of course, we have no idea, as they say, who the hell is this guy? But he just kind of comes in, and obviously there's a very pretty strong connection to his character in Sword of Doom. Did any of you guys pick up on that as far as his, you know, dark heart, you know, no conscience, killing machine, Ronan?
I mean, it's the same makeup on his face, basically. And it's not necessarily the same character in the way that Zatoichi meets Yojimbo. It's that Yojimbo character, but it's basically a callback to Sword of Doom. And I think you're meant to keep that character in specific in mind when you watch him in this, or, you know, you're kind of bringing the baggage of his other samurai films into this film when you watch Nakadai show up. And you know, like the hat, the image of him with the sword, it's
yeah, the postures he adopts when he's
like,
when
it's
he's
that character basically, you know.
And it's great. I mean, because I think, I mean, I don't know. It seems my understanding is that Sword of Doom has kind of grown in reputation. I mean, it was supposed to be not necessarily the start of a franchise, but at least there was a sequel in store, but it never got made. It was a pretty dark, nihilistic film. Still is, obviously. It hasn't really changed since they released it. But I think there's certainly been an audience that's grown to appreciate that film. But I don't know that it met with great success in the its original release, because it was just so incredibly bleak and intense. But it seems like there was at least enough of an audience to say, let's bring this character back. And now we get to see pretty much that same guy, and now he's in color. So I guess there's a little bit of a new twist on that.
The way that he can remove all emotion from his face, and except for fury, is incredible to me.
It is.
It's such a gift for an actor, because when most actors remove emotion from their faces, it's because they're awful actors who are wooden. But here, his eyes, I think, just imply that he's thinking, he's contemplating how savage he's about to be for the next few minutes, and it really does get under your skin.
Yeah, the horror of what he's just done as he's kind of twisting his sword into this man who has purchased what we learn later on to be his wife, this greedy, selfish, you know, heartless man bought his wife, and now he is exacting his revenge. And even though he perhaps feels some sense of justification in doing that, he's even appalled at his own, you know, viciousness, his own savagery. I mean, that's what you get in that kind of faraway expression as he's, you know, sentencing this man, this craven little coward, to death. It's like he's not taking any pleasure in that. It's just he's fulfilling his dreadful existential purpose, and you see all of that communicated in these dark, you know, abyss of his eyes and his grimacing facial expression. So,
and his final fight with Shintaro Katsu is just the amount of emotion the two of them put on their faces as they're contemplating how they're going to fight, what direction they're going to take this, even though they're not staring at one another, is amazing. I mean, Katsu doesn't even have his eyes to work with. No. He just has the rest of his face to work with. And, oh, it was just, it was everything.
Well, and the buildup throughout the film as Nakadai's character just kind of wanders in from time to time, seemingly random, but very effective.
He's taunting Zatoichi that basically the only reason why he's letting him live is because you're my one reason to live, but I'm going to be the one to kill you. And that's such a great little moment at the end, too, when it's the flash of the sword. It's the fact that he can see that disadvantages him during the fight, because they do build him up as being a superior sword fighter to Zatoichi, so you can believe that he's a credible threat, and then they find a nice way to make you believe why Zatoichi would come out on top in that fight scene. And just the little like flashback you get inserted in that one flash of light, it's not just that he's maybe blinded by the light, but you have him kind of thinking back to his wife and the chrysanthemums, and it all kind of happens in that one instant. It's really fantastic.
Yeah, his obsession with his wife, whether he regarded her as property or as his, you know, quest for vengeance, his lost honor. I mean, whatever it is. I mean, it's probably little bits of all of those things, but that was just the moment of distraction that ultimately cost him in this, you know, duel to the death. So, yeah, it's a great through line, even if it ultimately is a bit of a subplot. I guess it is the culmination of the film, so it's not just kind of a side thing. But the main story has to do with the Masayuki Mori character, this boss of bosses, who is really just, you know, basically out to he's playing games. I guess he feels kind of like a cat toying with his mice, both the bosses that he's, you know, in charge of, but even Zatoichi. He welcomes Zatoichi into this company. This film seems to play a little bit more than usual on Zatoichi's backstory, that he was a Yakuza himself. He was a criminal and well-known and regarded within these circles. He was never a boss. He was always kind of an enforcer or a henchman, but and there's never a really clear explication of how he lost his sight or what his exact role was. But, you know, in some of the films, he's just, you know, you don't really think of him as an ex-Yakuza, but this one here, really, that's what got him entree into this scene to begin with. But he's being manipulated as well by, another great Japanese character actor, Ko Nishimura, another familiar face. He's kind of a long faced guy. He tends to play a lot of supporting roles, but he's got this kind of great glumness to him. And he's a guy who's aspiring to move up in the criminal underworld and is actually named as a successor to the big boss's empire. But it's, again, part of a big ruse that he just wants, the big boss wants his underling to dedicate his daughter to this kind of sadistic game that he's playing with Zatoichi. He wants this woman to seduce Zatoichi so that he'll be taken off guard and suffer more torments en route to his ultimate demise than if he were just a straight up kill him, as if that could realistically be done in a Zatoichi film.
I mean, the character, kind of in a nutshell, the big boss, when he's toying with Zatoichi, comes near the end when he says, well, I'll make a bet for your life or her life. And Zatoichi's always been good at gambling because he can hear the dice moving around and he seems to always figure out if it's an odd or even number. But then you find out that there is no marking on the dice, and it's just this ruse, basically, yeah, to torture him. That
the joke's for you. You are going to lose no matter what. Odd or even, make your call. It's neither. Ha ha.
Now, really quick, Martin, how many have you watched the entire series?
Yeah, I've never seen the TV show, but how I got into these films was a little bit backwards, because I had seen the Takashi Kitano remake. I think it came out like early 2000s, and that film, even though it's a remake, it kind of borrows bits and pieces from all the films in the series, or is the better films in the series. And I don't know, have either of you seen the remake?
I have not. I have the Blu-ray. Okay. I ordered it a while back, but I feel like I want to kind of get through the original film series at least, and then I'll watch the remake and do it in that order.
Because I think the remake...
I have certainly not.
Okay, because it takes a lot from this film in particular, so I think that sort of shows that maybe this one stuck out in people's minds, because when it comes time to remake it, it's like, oh, you have to have the forlorn Ronin who comes in to fight Zatoichi, and you have to have the sort of similar gangster character on top who's playing games. And even in the remake, Zatoichi, one of the characters he helps is a cross-dresser. And even though you don't have cross-dressing in this one, Pita, of course, was in the Funeral Parade of Roses and kind of had that persona. And in this film, he's very flirtatious with Zatoichi, even though he's trying to... At first, he's trying to kill him, but then he settles for a slap, which is kind of a funny scene. But It's,
well, I'm very interested in exploring that whole character, so let's get into it now that he's here.
Are all of the movies this, and I say this as a member of the LGBTQ community, mm-hmm. are they all this gay? Or is this the exception to the rule?
This one's kind of the exception, yeah. There's little bits, this is, but...
The homoeroticism is definitely up front in this one here. So, yeah, Robert, what's your response to that?
Nothing really offended me per se. Okay. If they want to have a huge naked fight in a spa, I'm not going to complain. Yeah. And the Peter stuff, even though he was talking about asserting his masculinity, and there is the moment where Zatoichi cuts off a little of his long hair, mm-hmm. I felt like at the end it was just, you be you, buddy. You go mm-hmm. figure it out for yourself, which I thought was a nice note to end it on. Mm-hmm. The weird, we're having sex, but also you're going to stab me under the covers that lasted like a minute was a mm-hmm. little weird, but again, I went with it.
Sure. Well, you know, it is interesting. I mean, because PETA, or Peter, as his name is typically spelled out in English, apparently, and I have not seen Funeral Parade of Roses. I'm familiar with its kind of cult following, and I would love to check it out at some point. I just got to get a hold of the disc or find a way to view it. But yeah, Martin, do you have any kind of context for this character? I know he was in Ron later on back.
Right,
later
that's on in the where 80s. I
died. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
I mean, he was a little bit of a cult figure and sort of associated mm-hmm. with these very feminine type roles, or like not playing women, but often you'll see him cross dressing or playing the kind of like boyish, flirtatious page or something like that. Like he had a lot of those types of roles. And Funeral Parade of Roses, it's sort of interesting. It's basically a remake that inverts Oedipus Rex. So he ends up killing his mother and sleeping with his father, and at the end, of course, gets blinded. So it's kind of funny going from one film that ends with him being blind at the very end to Zatoichi, where, you know, he's interacting with this famous blind character.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, he's clearly very heavily made up. His effeminate, pansexual type of characteristics are definitely, you know, they are in some ways the butt of some humor, but it's not a condescending or nasty, mean-spirited type of thing. It seems somewhat, I don't know, progressive and inclusive, if I could use kind of the 21st century language, and how that character was handled, because like you say, Martin, it seems like he has a bit of a cult following, and there's a few other supporting bits that I think we might want to get into. It feels like this movie's made up of a bunch of cameos of characters who may have been familiar to their Japanese audiences more than they are to us, based on how the characters are framed, how the little skits or moments that they appear are put out. They almost reminded me of some of the 60s Batman bits, where some famous, you know, ephemeral celebrity of the time would come out and do a wisecrack or have a little bit there. I'm thinking of like the couple that's kind of the husband
viciously
and wife who are
attacking each
other. Yeah, right. Like, yeah, it almost feels like
sequence. Yeah.
Right. Right, and that, you know, especially the woman, she's very vigorous, very athletic. I mean, she gets tossed around pretty bluntly, and it's like, yeah, I could imagine these people were probably kind of known for doing that type of a thing, and maybe on some Japanese TV show or bit parts in other movies or whatever. But back to the Peter character, you're right, and then again, you got the nude sword fighting scene, the men in the bath, and all of that. Was this just Japanese cinema kind of saying, hey, let's venture into some new territory here? It's just very interesting to me. And again, Zatoichi, you know, he's not really trying to reshape Peter, but he is kind of mocking a little bit of his vanity, the little, you know, the hair slicing bit there. And again, Peter's, you know, pretty clearly heavily mascaraed eyes and the foundation and the makeup and all of that.
It feel, as you mentioned, weirdly ahead of its time, and I was kind of surprised the character didn't come back for the climax, and then I was curious if he ever appeared in any other films, but I assume he did not.
I don't think he's in any other Zatoichi films, but again, I'm watching him as we go, so I haven't gone on to the last four installments following this one.
Because they do sort of set up that he could possibly come back, alas.
But he is given kind of a positive send-off, you know, not exactly heroic, but, yeah, like you said, Robert, you be you, and they had their moment, their encounter, you know, and he's also playing to the character's kind of greed and vanity, you know, the guy that, you know, his mission is to kill Zatoichi, to resist the temptation of all that money dangling out the window like a chime, and man up in his own way, I guess.
Yeah, the thing that's interesting to me about this Zatoichi film, I mean, this film in general, I suppose, is that despite the fact that, and you did a wonderful job telling us what the plot was, but all that really matters is the characters and the writers, and I believe, if I am correct, that Katsu is one of the co-writers, seems more interested in just crafting individual characters who make a huge impression and then sort of ushering them off stage, which it works. I remember all of the small characters. I remember the woman who he rescues. I remember the Peter character. I remember the couple who are fighting. They're really interesting, engaging characters who linger with me longer than even the action, which I think is incredibly well done. But I feel like perhaps because he was an actor, he said, let's figure out ways to make characters who really pop, even if they're coming on for only a scene or two. And it worked.
Yeah, well, Katsu had really kind of taken ownership of the franchise. He was a very central figure. In fact, I think another reason for some of the delays between the, you know, kind of the earlier run of the films and then the Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo and the films after, is that he became, he kind of started his own production company. Films are still released under the Dai Studios, but I think he had his own kind of independent sort of business going on, so that he had a lot more creative control over the franchise. And I think, you know, I don't know the facts, but I may be speculating a little bit. I think that's maybe what led him into the TV series. Mm-hmm. After the films had kind of run their course, he had even more control and could maybe do just shorter, you know, hour-long episodes or whatever. But from a friend of mine who's watched all of them and actually owns the DVD series of the TV shows, he says they're all pretty remarkably consistent quality. So I may end up at some point following through and tracking down the TV series one way or another.
The TV series is worth seeing. And also, he directed one more Zatoichi film that came in the 80s that was sort of later. That's kind of a controversial film. But I think what you're saying about him going a little bit more independent and that leading to television, that was sort of happening throughout the entire Japanese film industry around this time. Like, I was just thinking it's the same era as that I forget the name of the studio. It was like the Four Musketeers or something like that, that Kurosawa and a few others formed and led to Kurosawa producing and directing Dodeskaden, right? Which came out the same year. So like that was also trying to change things up. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about how the film's trying to be a little bit ahead of its time, or at least contemporary to other things that are going on. I think by 1970, these, you know, sword fight movies were starting to seem a little bit old-fashioned, and I think there was a sense that, we have to update it in certain ways, we have to be a little bit more in touch, we can't just, you know, have Zatoichi fighting Yojimbo over and over again. I think they had to try to find ways to keep it fresh, and so much of the industry kind of shifted towards television, then it made sense that something that was, you know, they were doing like two films every year at a certain point, that, yeah, this should be a TV show and you're going to have Zatoichi come in and affect people's lives for the better, or maybe kill them or whatever, and then move on. You know, it kind of has that formula where every film at a certain point, it's like Zatoichi comes to town, he improves some lives, he kills the bad guys, and he moves on. It may, you know, maybe he loses somebody along the way, or like it has that kind of basic structure. So I think, you know, it's right that the characters are the things that stand out, because the actual plotting is pretty stock and at a certain point pretty formulaic. So I think it's more in in the details and the craft, you know, and the characters that make each one memorable in the way that a TV series you watch over a long period of time. You know, you don't exactly remember every episode of Star Trek, but you remember Spock and McCoy, like, you
know,
stuff like
their
that.
Interactions and you know, so you know, in each Zatoichi film, there's the gambling bit, there's the sword tricks, you know, there's the big showdowns, there's the, you know, humorous interactions with kids or poor peasants or crazy old women or whatever the case may be. And so you sort of just have to check those boxes off. But yeah, as I've said in previous blogs and even, you know, podcasts about, you know, there's just a comfort of visiting those formulas and those routines, that the comfort and the predictability of it, as long as there's enough of a creative twist or edge on it to make it feel like it's not just a complete recycling of the same old.
Sure.
And it did like feel like it had some... Go ahead, Martin.
I was just going to say, like, it's like a James Bond film where you kind of know what to expect, but if they don't kind of find ways to update it and, you know, add something to it, then after a while you get sick of it pretty quick and they have to sort of scrap it and reboot it, or, you know, it's similar.
Sure. Well, and Robert, you are a screenwriter in episode TV. So, you know, what are your thoughts as far as, you know, meeting the challenge of kind of, you know, hitting the notes, but doing it with kind of a fresh variation?
Well, since this is my second film, it's a little difficult for me to say, but what I would say is the filmmakers do find all of these small moments within the film itself that seem fresh and new, like the bit where he chops the guy's mug in half.
Yep.
How had they not thought of it yet? But we're on the 21st film, and it seems delightful. Or I already mentioned the playing of the board game where they can remember where the chips are.
Yeah.
By
touch.
The sound.
Or the sound, yeah.
And what? The bit with the die that Martin mentioned earlier, it seems fresh. It seems new. It seems like they're finding endless variations on what could be a very simple structure. So it felt great to me.
Yeah. Well, and if you enjoy that stuff, I definitely recommend backtracking and going through some of the middle episodes, if you will, because, you know, actually some of the stunts and gimmicks and tricks of the earlier films are I would say superior. To this film's credit, I don't think they really tried to outdo it. I mean, there are some pretty crazy stunts with Zatoichi, you know, catching candles on the edge of his sword. And, I mean, just some really ridiculously superhuman type of stuff, which they kind of toned down a bit here, if you can believe that.
On the storytelling, it's so lean in some of them. Yeah. Like, I think it's the second one. It's only 70-something minutes long, and it's like one of the leanest films I've ever seen. Like, it ends before the bad guy hits the ground dead. It's just, you know, that kind of bang, bang, bang pace. And after, you know, these films kind of find a little bit more room to breathe and moments to enjoy. Like, one of my favorite sequences in Zatoichi Goes to the Fire Festival is just when he's enjoying the sounds and you have the kids laughing and then it cuts to birds chirping. It's a really great cut.
Yeah,
it's
these just little these, like, natural insets there, right?
Yeah,
right.
You know, and it's just how he enjoys the day, hearing all these sort of happy sounds. Like, I thought that was such a great kind of laid-back moment in between all this action and intrigue.
I really love that. I really felt like this was a nicely rounded... I mean, that was my first response of watching it just a couple nights ago, was just, oh my goodness, this just... Yeah, right, it just felt very organic, and you really had a nicely fulfilled picture of Zatoichi the person. And some of the films earlier in the series are a little bit maybe heavier on the philosophical side, or maybe more dedicated to pure action, or they're kind of elaborate setups for the big set piece at the end. This one here just really felt like it just really flowed very seamlessly from one aspect of the Zatoichi character to the other. And just a lot of credit to the director, who just seemed to have a very confident, accomplished sense of what he was trying to achieve here.
Can I ask a question following up on what you're saying?
Sure,
David?
Sure.
So, since you guys have seen the first movies, how much of a sense of continuity, and I apologize to all of the wonderful listeners who have watched all the Zatoichi films before me, but what how much continuity is there between films? Do characters ever recur like an M character from a James Bond series, or is there ever like a two-part sort of like Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace?
Sometimes.
Is it all just self-contained?
Like, you'll have a character from the second one come back in the fifth one, and like I think more the first few have a sense of continuity, and after that they become more like one-offs, and
yeah, the first two are almost like part one and part two of the same story, yeah.
Or you'll have something like Zatoichi's Pilgrimage, where it's kind of like him going to atone for some of the things that have happened in the previous films, or like, it's sort of... I think even the films themselves realize that, okay, not everyone's going to have watched, you know, a dozen films or two dozen films, so like, you know, we have to have a little bit of leeway in what people can remember or think back to. So I think some of them, they do try to become more self-contained over time.
And I think you know, obviously we're well before any kind of home media DVD VHS era, so you know, people's impressions of the films were probably just from seeing it a couple years ago or whatever, so there wasn't this encyclopedic recollection, there was no fan base to keep track of all the plots, so I don't think they really wanted to make this kind of a binge-watching type of thing with one long linear narrative. I mean, you can watch them out of order, roughly speaking, and pretty much still have the same experience. So,
And I'm also curious for you guys, and I'm sorry I'm sort of taking over by asking questions, but I'm also curious for you guys, what is your favorite Zatoichi film? Because are there others that meet this in terms of quality, or is this sort of an outlier in that it's super duper awesome? I'm just curious.
You know, I don't know. I mean, this would definitely be in my upper tier. This is probably at least at the moment in my top five. I think, just recalling from titles, I think Zatoichi and the Chest of Gold and Zatoichi and the Chess Master, those two are titles that sort of stand out in my memory as like, I really dug those quite a bit, but I can't exactly tell you what made them so distinctive. What do you think, Martin?
It sort of depends what mood you're in. Like you said, some of them are a little bit more philosophical, some of them are a little bit more action-packed, so it kind of depends what mood I'm in. I mean, yeah. My favorite, it's the remake, actually, the Takashi Kitano remake, if you guys ever get a chance to see it, partly because it does sort of cherry-pick all these things that have worked throughout the films, and Takashi Kitano is a great filmmaker in his own right, who kind of came and put his own spin on the character. So like of course not in the Criterion box set, but I would sort of hope that anyone who's seen all these films might actually want to give the remake a chance and see how it sort of builds a kind of archetypical Zatoichi story.
Yeah, I think also, you know, a couple others that stand out, and I definitely will give that remake a chance, because I think this is a great character of Japanese cinema, Japanese storytelling. I just, again, the other night read the Tale of Zatoichi short story that's kind of the foundation for all of this, that's included in the kind of hardcover book insert in the Blu-ray and DVD box set, and it mentions his gambling prowess, it mentions his swordsmanship skill, how he can flash the sword, slice objects in midair, and have it back in its sheath before you even knew that he drew his weapon. So, you know, that kind of foundational character, I'm certainly not far from a master of all Japanese folklore, but it seems to me that Zatoichi, by virtue of this series, has become kind of an archetype of Japanese kind of pop mythology. Zatoichi's Pilgrimage, Martin mentioned earlier, is one of those heavier philosophical films where you feel like the character's kind of coming to terms with all of the violence, all of the destruction that he has wrought. Not necessarily that he sought to do that, but he's been forced to by circumstances, and yet he's still been a man of profound violence. And then again, the earlier films do kind of give you a little bit more of that direct connection to the classic Chanbara genre films, you know, those old Kurosawa and other black and white samurai classics. They kind of feel like they've kind of grown out of that tradition. By the time you're at this point in the series, you're definitely more into, you know, that kind of pop culture blend of comedy, action, you know, cameo set pieces and star, you know, guest star appearances and things of that sort. This does feel like a film that was meant to, you know, generate a big box office, win a lot of, you know, popular audience appeal and all of that. And I think it succeeds quite magnificently in that respect.
I mean, it had, like, in all honesty, you know how negative I was, and I'm not trying to bring it up again.
That's
but
fine,
you
yeah.
know how much I hated Meet Yojimbo.
Yeah, and well, so, and I think...
And by the way, kudos to John Lobinger for being like, no, you have to come back, and then abandoning us.
Well, and how much of your disappointment or despising of the Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo is based on, you know, diminished expectations. I mean, you came into it thinking this is going to be awesome, and it was just confusing and bloated and all of that. If it didn't have the Yojimbo name and it was just a film, how do you think your reaction might have been any different?
I don't think I would have ever watched it. No, I actually think I would have probably had a similar reaction. Mm-hmm. Part of the thing is, it's called Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo, so you have a certain expectation.
Sure.
Just like when you go to Zatoichi goes to the fire festival, well, you have an expectation that he'll go to a fire festival, but let's set that aside.
Right.
You have an expectation for what type of movie it is, because it's such a fun name, and that one was all brooding and twisting darkness, whereas this one is fun and delightful and fireworks and Zatoichi almost tripping over a cliff for no reason. Like, that's what I assumed that the series was all along, and then it was all that and more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just kind of a you know, go for broke adventure with you know, all the bits, the funny parts, the action parts, all of that.
And how lovely was that femme fatale? Like, we've talked about most of
awesome,
the other actors, but she did such a good job at varying her reactions to Zatoichi over the course of the film, to really ending up liking him. And the scene past the climax, where she talks with him and he sort of gives her the cold shoulder, really affected me in a way that I was surprised that it did.
Yeah, when he tells her you can't fool a blind man, that's pretty cool.
I was like, ooh, but she likes you.
Well, and there's definitely, I mean, you know, Shintaro Katsu, I think he enjoyed, you know, playing himself up as this, you know, desirable, you know, man's man and all of that. And he certainly does have a number of beautiful young women who fall for him to various degrees. And he kind of, you know, very, very sternly, but, you know, kind of just treads to his own course and pursues his own calling. But Reiko Ohara is her name, and she did a very, very nice job in conveying the nuances of this character. And, you know, I mean, she goes into it with this kind of cold-hearted seductress. She's just going to, you know, follow her orders and make this guy pay, because she just thinks he's just another, you know, thug like the rest of these men that she's, you know, been caught up with and in some sense born into this world. And then she senses there's this something different about Zatoichi, this kind of nobility, this simplicity, and just, you know, the way he wants to take care of her when she stubs her toe. And she might even be playing up her injury just to try to, you know, seduce him in a little bit more, but she senses his, you know, fundamental innocence, his lack of guile, and has kind of a converting effect on her. But I agree, her characterization is exceptional, and I don't know that she went on to become a big star. I mean, her IMDb page doesn't necessarily jump out at me with other big roles, but she certainly handled her tasks here quite commendably.
And the other thing that I just had to mention was the music by Isao Tomita, and I know I'm mispronouncing the name, and I apologize, but I'm giving him a compliment, so he probably will forgive me. But at the end, like, especially at the end, the way that he played the themes through during that final fight was just stunning. It could have easily just been normal action, bum, 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 but instead he infused it with an emotion that was very unexpected, so kudos to him as well.
Well, he showed a lot of range. I mean, let's talk about his soundtrack music to the bathhouse scene.
Was there electric guitar in there? There was something strange, I thought.
It was. Well, you know, I mean, one of the links in my show notes likened it to kind of the Batman zap, pow, biff, boom, bam music on steroids. And I think that he's onto something, the writer there. It definitely kind of had this kind of over-the-top psycho explosion. It was really, really funny, and again, not every Zatoichi film has that kind of pop sensibility in its musical soundtrack. Sometimes it's very traditional, kind of old school, you know, Japanese, you know, acoustic music. But this really had a nice blend of styles and mood pieces.
I think the highest compliment I can give it is I will happily watch the next one.
All right. Well, that's a pretty high praise, considering where you were at just a few months ago.
I'm not going to lie, David. I truly was like, do I just cancel on him? Should I just say no? And then I was like, no, I get to spend time with David Blakesley. What a badass motherfucker. So I decided I was going to, you know, suck it up and watch the movie. And within 20 minutes, I was like, yay. And then, sorry to geek out a little bit, but Martin, I love when you're guesting on the Criterion podcast.
Oh, thank
you. I'm so happy that we finally got a chat.
Yeah,
chance to
I'm
talk
glad
as
you
well.
Came back for more Zatoichi. It's fun to talk with you about it.
Well, yeah, to me, I mean, getting you two together is like getting Nakadai and Mori on the same screen. So, been a real delight for me. So, yeah, any final comments before we move on to a couple other little you know, bits of business here?
Oh, I just got to mention the I like that. Katsu, he almost starred in Kagemusha for Kurosawa, and then he dropped out, of course, and I like that Nakadai was the one who came in and replaced him, so Nakadai got the last laugh. Maybe.
Well, I mean, I have to put Nakadai, you know, a notch or two. I mean, I haven't seen Katsu's, you know, I guess I've seen about half of Hanzo the Razor, the first
film. Those movies are kind of gross, I think. But
yeah. I'm not exactly eager to get into those, but no. I guess that's kind of the next phase. We'll cover them at some point down the road. But Nakadai just had such an amazing career. I mean, I honestly have to think that he's probably my favorite Japanese actor.
I think so. I would put him even above Mifune. Like, his intensity, like, you know, Harakiri, like all his films with Kobayashi, and of course Kurosawa, particularly the later Kurosawa stuff, I think it's really incredible.
And there's just the range. I mean, Mifune did, he definitely stretched out. I mean, he did I Live in Fear, and you know, he did some other stuff, you know, High and Low, and you know, where he wasn't always just the crazy samurai guy, or the brooding samurai guy. But Nakadai was just unbelievable. I mean, you know, he really could inhabit each role, and of such a diverse type. So, you know, he's the tops, maybe one of the greatest actors of all time, actually, outside of just Japanese cinema per se. Yeah,
I concur.
So I mean, and props to Katsu for bringing Nakadai on, because I mean, if there's a place where a leading man might be shown up by a supporting cast, this is one where the threat was very real there.
The one that came after this was the One-Armed Swordsman, right? So
that's
like
supposed to be a pretty good
like
one
sort of
as well.
Guest stars coming in, that was sort of the. Mm-hmm. The thing for Zatoichi for a little while. You had to have like some big heavy come in.
Well, and maybe this was an attractive vehicle for those actors themselves. You know, I'm sure there was probably a pretty generous payday and a kind of a high profile guest star without them having to feel the weight of having to carry the whole film. So kind of the best bowler. Do we want to talk a little bit about the big set piece at the end? I guess, you know, the film, the bit that kind of gives the film its name. Zatoichi surrounded in flames. I mean, it's pretty memorable. It seems like a bit of a quick and easy escape when it gets right down to it, though. I mean, he is completely surrounded by these towering walls of intense volcanic flame, and then all of a sudden you see him sort of swimming.
They didn't have to bust out the underwater camera, so it's
exactly. And it doesn't seem like that pool really should have been that deep to begin with, you know. I mean, he's in some kind of a little pond, and now you see him, you know, swimming under what seems to be about a 6 foot or so, you know, body of water. So, but realism, I guess we have to sort of check that card
really
at the door.
There's a really similar shot in True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger, in Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, there's a very, very similar shot when he's underwater and you see the fire over top. So it made me think of that. But actually, what I like even more than the big fire set piece is his final confrontation with Maury when he's going to drop his sword. That's... And that showdown, I think that's such
and
a cool
walks,
payoff with the little daggers on the bottom of his arm.
Yeah,
Did he guys have this little guard? Sorry, go ahead, David.
Well, yeah, he has this little guard, and it's just kind of basically a short spear, and it's you know, again, Zatoichi has perfectly plotted this ahead. He staggers blindly towards his doom, and again, you know, Zatoichi is completely defenseless. He could just send his men in, slice him to ribbons, and that would be that, but he has to, as he says, he has to take his time with his pleasures, and that's his fatal hubris, his undoing, as Zatoichi gets the last little twist in there and sticks the pike through his neck. And
the way he plays that moment, but the way it's lit on his face, and did something happen? It's such an eerie moment.
It is.
I thought
that was and really he has this nice, slow, spectacular, collapsing death.
Now, there is this moment in the final battle, not with the boss, but when he's taking on the minions. Mm-hmm. Tell me if you guys saw this, but there is this moment where it appears that Zatoichi's sword, or pardon me, Katsu's sword, because I'm talking outside when they're making the film, actually seems to hit one of the extras in the shoulder.
I think because there was a fair amount of that went on back in the day. Yeah.
The guy truly screams as if he's been hit, and I was like, blood does not normally come from, like, those sort of spaces before he falls down, and I was like, good lord! I rewound it 2 or 3 times, and I was like, I wonder if they just left it in the movie.
It could be. I mean, stuff like that did happen. The last Zatoichi film, the one in the 80s that kind of put the series to bed for a while, somebody got killed on the film, so that was kind of what ended Zatoichi.
And that was Katsu himself basically playing.
Or I thought it was his son, maybe.
Who
killed somebody? So that was kind of
scandal. As far as the fatality, I'm not sure, but Katsu himself played Zatoichi. They didn't bring anybody else in.
He directed it. That was like his. You know, he was doing something almost like what Eastwood had done with Unforgiven, where he's kind of bringing the character back, and he's older, and he's trying to make it very serious. Like, that one's pretty heavy. There's some fun stuff where he's juggling a baby, but that one's pretty dour, I think. Like, the tone is quite dark compared to just about any of these.
And that's probably fitting. Again, I won't leap too far ahead, but it seems like a series like this, you really can't exit, you know, for laughs. You know, I mean, this is a fundamentally a very tragic storyline of a very violent, cruel, and oppressive era in Japanese history, and a society that really exploited and condemned a whole lot of people to a miserable fate. That's the thing. For all the violence and even some of the laughter that these crazy scenes might elicit in us and in our as viewers, I mean, there is ultimately a deep-seated sorrow to what's going on here, and I think that's appropriate. I mean, you know, you find kind of the acid-laced dark humor in it all, because sometimes it is pretty bitterly funny, but ultimately, yeah, this is a story of a world that's gone terribly, terribly wrong. So I do highly recommend this particular.
But it's also
song.
Fun.
It is fun, right? Laughter in the misery, I guess, is one way of putting it. But also just an example of extremely, competent and more than that filmmaking. I mean, again, this is a film that just glides along and seems to be, you know, made with an expert hand. I mean, just the framing, the compositions, the visual elements, the music. We've already talked about all these things, so this does seem to be one of the showcase episodes, and if you are just looking for a random starting point and want to get into the Zatoichi series, I think this is a pretty good one. I think you get all the elements there without necessarily giving too much away or requiring a lot of earlier studies if you don't want to just start from episode one.
Yeah, they definitely don't get egg in the face. Oh, thank you guys for the mercy laugh. Thank you so much. I was so worried about how that was going to go.
No, it just reminds me of another great scene from early on in the film, and just again the humor and the little moments of justice and equity when this this thuggish moron starts hassling these poor little farmers, and Zatoichi just writes things and settles the score very effectively, very efficiently. I love
it. Just the image of Zatoichi with the egg in his mouth, and that's all white, and you see the white of his eyes is such like a great image on its own. I don't know, it sticks out in your mind.
Excellent. Okay, let's kind of wrap up our conversation about Zatoichi Goes to the Fire Festival. Last comments, or are we all pretty much spent on that regard?
I'm tired.
All right. Well, Robert, we're gonna tax your patience just a little bit more, because you have a story to tell. You have every Criterion Collector fan's worst nightmare as part of your lived experience. So let me just kind of hand it over to you, and I'm sure you've put that out there on Facebook. You've answered a few questions. People have gotten a little gist of what's going on, but what you been through, man? Tell us your story.
So a couple of weeks ago in LA, it was 118 degrees, and I was house sitting up in Cable Canyon, which is this place where it's a little cooler and there's some breezes. And I took three Criterions and an awful movie called Moontide with me that I was going to watch while I was there. I was there for 6 days. And when I came back, I arrived into my apartment to see that the penthouse that often shoots films over my apartment, some sort of pipe had backed up, broken, and literally there were just two small holes, one of which was over my coffee table and one of which was over my Blu-ray cabinet. So my little coffee table was gone, which I was not, I could give a shit about. But every single one of my box sets, every single one of my Criterions, every single one of my DVDs and Blu-rays was destroyed. So I had to restart completely with The Breaking Point, Mildred Pierce, and fucking Moontide. Those were the only movies that I had and still have to my name currently. It was truly just a nightmare, and I'm not allowed to say what show was shooting, but I will say it was an NBC show that rhymes with Kliss Miss Us.
Bastards.
I called the insurance, and first, I don't think the insurance believed that it just happened to hit all of the most expensive stuff in my apartment, but finally they came around, and apparently I'm getting paid. I was supposed to get paid today, but there is something holding up the check, so I will get it later this week. I hope to have it by the end of the Barnes & Noble sale, hopefully. We'll see.
But so again, my jaw is kind of dropping over here as I try to envision myself walking into a scenario like that. It just you've called it a nightmare. It's just kind of like this surreal, out of body experience. And again, for listeners who maybe don't know you as well, how extensive was your Criterion collection?
I had approximately 500, maybe a little less than 500 DVDs and Blu-rays. Of course I'm not getting an entire reimbursement of it, which sucks, but it's going to be enough to start to rebuild. The thing that kills me the most is my out of prints.
I
will never be able to get back unless I drop hundreds of dollars online. Like, I know Notorious is coming back in print, and I know Spellbound is coming back in print. But, like, Chungking Express.
And just the sheer labor, the work, the, if scrounging for bargains. I mean, I've been through that process. I would never want to go through it again. I think about younger or newer collectors who are trying to get complete, whether that's whatever stage of completion you might define. I mean, I got all that taken care of back in 2010, and I've just kind of been maintaining ever since. But it's like, if I really had to rebuild, and I'm not trying to talk you out of anything, Robert, it's just like, my heart just goes out to you. It's just so daunting to think, how can you reconstruct all of that? Barnes & Noble, flash sales, whatever, be damned. It's like, how do you summon the energy for such an endeavor, right?
It's absolutely devastating because, as I'm sure you guys know, your film taste and the movies that you choose to buy are your culture. And they right. tell the story of who you are right. as someone who loves movies. Mm-hmm. And so to have it completely wiped off of me because of some stupid backed up septic tank upstairs.
And so when you say they're ruined, I mean, obviously this isn't just water damage. This is what? Sewage? Sludge.
No, the discs are warped.
The discs are warped, right. So that was the other thing I was thinking. Well, maybe the covers are ruined, but at least you got the discs. But the discs themselves, their shape is bent.
Jeez. It's so horrible.
Discs were complete, because I had the exact same reaction you guys had. I was like, oh, thank God. And then I pulled out my Carl Theodore Dreyer collection, and I was like, let's check it out. And then poor Carl, he was bent.
So the discs themselves are obviously
not impervious
to water.
It makes me
want to
give up physical media, like, tonight.
Yeah, it makes me want to go out and buy a 12-terabyte hard drive and just rip everything, you know? It's just like, oh my gosh, including scanning the booklets and all of that. So, well,
yeah, it is, as I said, the nightmare.
Yeah.
But what can you do? You just have to restart collecting.
Well, I mean, you know, living out there in California, I see, you know, fire season and the devastation when these crazy forest fires, floods, hurricanes. You know, I've never known any other Criterion collectors who've actually been through those kind of broad-scale natural disasters. But here you are in your cozy little apartment, and you walk back, and everything seems normal until you realize, appallingly, it is not. And there's nothing that can be done about it. So do you feel like the insurance company is at least giving you a fair break? Or, I mean,
I think so. Like,
oh, I'm laughing with you, buddy. Not at you.
And then have them somehow hear and be like, "Never mind, we're canceling the FedEx delivery." But it should be—it's realistically half of what all rebuilding the collection is going to be. But what can you say? I will say the one good thing that come out of this, and it's not even a good thing. It's just the luckiest thing that could have possibly happened to me is my. My most prized possession, the possession that I fully intend to give to my children and be passed on to my children's children, is I have a first edition of To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh.
And it was sitting on one of the shelves, and right before I left, I moved it over to a different bookshelf. So had it been on the shelf, it would have been ruined.
Wow.
But literally, I just thought to myself, oh, the sun is hitting that book. I should move it so that it doesn't get any damage. And I was not thinking of the type of damage that was going to get it.
No.
So at least from some divine intervention, my To Kill a Mockingbird first edition is somehow saved. Everything else, though...
Well,
but it's all replaceable. I'm still alive, right?
Yeah, of course.
I still have the
just
memories.
Think about the character you built. It's...
you're a stronger person because of this, Robert. Well, and I hope you genuinely hope you felt the outreach of friends. I mean, like I say, I do have a stock of surplus DVDs, my upgrades, and I'm willing to talk to you offline and see if there's a little care package we can put together on your behalf.
Oh, that's so sweet of you, David.
Thank you
so much.
Genuinely, Robert. I mean, because I, you know, my empathy, I won't say my empathy knows no bounds, but I'm certainly very moved by your situation, and I really appreciate what you've brought to this podcast, and just our friendship, you know, all of that. So, you know, I just think
I'll give you my Filmstruck password as a trade.
Okay. Well, I got my own Filmstruck thing going, but that's fine.
Damn it, David. Would you like a really awful movie on DVD called Moontide in response? Fritz Lang started directing it and then decided it was too awful, so he left it.
You got to start trading somewhere. You just keep trading it for something better and better and better, and then you'll work way up to Chungking Express.
we'll negotiate this one out, my friend. So, yeah, well, okay. Well, any other little bits you want to fill us in on, Robert, before I kick over to Martin for him to give us a
if you thing? Have kids, godkids, cousins, little cousins, my new season of Spirit, Riding Free, is coming out mid-August.
Is that
so
season three now?
Check it out on season six.
Season six. Oh, my goodness. I've been asleep at the wheel here.
Yes. So, check it out on Netflix.
Excellent. Cool. Yeah, yeah. Well, Netflix seasons aren't like necessarily like a year. They're kind of in big bunches there, and
we release every 4 to 5 months now.
Okay, I'm duly informed. Martin, what you been up to? I think you've already talked a little bit about some of the things going on. No, that's a topper.
Check
there.
Out FlixWise. I've been on a wrong reel recently. I've been on the High Low podcast, which I think might be coming to an end soon. That's been going through all of Kurosawa's films. That's a really good one. And
okay, it's called the High and Low Podcast. I don't think I ever heard of it.
Oh,
so
those
what
guys
did you
great.
Talk about with them?
We talked about Dodeska Den, so that's
okay.
Right around this time period, and
that'll be coming up on this
1970
podcast.
Japanese cinema on my mind, but
perfect.
That's a good conversation because
David and I are going to be discussing it together.
Oh, okay,
yeah. Robert has an opinion on that film.
That's my least favorite Kurosawa film, so it was really fun to have like a conversation about it. I found that kind of cathartic.
Oh my god, it's so bad. What was he thinking?
It's. I mean,
he's trying to keep
I
up
mean,
the
David,
whole
I hope you enjoyed. God bless.
I have lots of opinions about why it is the way it is and what comes after, and that's a big conversation. But I hope you guys have fun discussing it.
Yeah, no, I will definitely listen to that episode in preparation, and we'll have some dialogue.
Sure.
So
I'll send it to you.
I know a little bit of the backstory of Dodeska Den, and have not watched it yet, but I'm fascinated to see how Kurosawa responded to, you know, the Art Theater Guild and other things that were happening at this time of Japanese cinema. So I'm expecting...
Get some sake before you get started.
Okay.
I mean, how... Never mind. Okay, we'll talk about it. To be continued in 2 months.
Hold that thought, Robert. We'll give you your opportunity. Yeah,
I can send you the conversation so you guys can hear. But there's that. There's a bunch of FlixWise stuff on the way. Nobody can see my art gallery stuff in Canada. Nobody's going to listen.
Send me a link. I'll put it in the show notes.
And if you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at Movie Kessler, and that's about it, I think.
Okay. Now, did you do Alexei Herman episodes or series or something like that?
Oh, I did. It's,
I finally got the Blu-ray of Hard to Be a God. There was, what was that, a Kino sale recently? I picked it up. I haven't watched it yet, but it's in my queue somewhere. So
there's a Kino Lorber Blu-ray and an Arrow Blu-ray, and the Arrow Blu-ray, it's also region free if people are curious. I think it has a little bit of a better translation too, but they both have different special features. Okay. But I wrote a 5-part series about Alexei German's life and films, going, you know, all the way from his birth in 1930s up to his death, and just it's not a big filmography, but I think it's the most anyone's ever written about him in English. So
I get the sense that this is kind of not authoritative or definitive, but pretty deep dive, and so I do feel like I want to make my acquaintance. So it's kind of bookmarked, and I'll be getting into it somewhere in the relatively near future, I hope.
Cool. If anyone's ever been curious, that's the thing for. Oh, sorry.
There you go. No, that's good. I think we're just kind of at wrap up time. So, links to contact us, find us online are going to be in the show notes. Guys, it's been a very stimulating, wonderful conversation. I fully expected it would be, and you guys hit the mark. So thank you for joining me in this very fun, rousing conversation about an excellent Zatoichi film.
We were on fire.
I was waiting for somebody to say it.
We burned down the house. Okay, guys.
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk to y'all real soon then, and good night. Thank you.
結構な湯でございました。